And good morning, everyone. Welcome to the other side of midnight, that interesting time between dusk and dawn, when the things that we kind of take for granted during daytime and dismiss as, oh, that can't be, or that's too wild or improbable, those things at night, after sunset, take on a whole new light. As you're going to be seeing this morning when I get to our guest, but I have a couple things I want to do at the top of the show. One of the things that I've been very intrigued by in the last couple of days is that we're in the midst of what I would term anniversary mania. Do you realize that tonight, actually technically last night, this happened 49 years ago? And the world would never be the same. A guy named Gene Roddenberry took to a network called NBC a startling program called Star Trek. And at the top of the othersideofmidnight.com website tonight, there are two links, one to the Los Angeles Times and one to Variety, two different takes on what Gene managed to pull off 49 years ago. Because the actual anniversary, the 50th anniversary that we all make a big deal about, is actually not until a year from tonight. But 49 years ago tonight, well, kind of last night, when Gene got on the air, something amazing, amazing, that had never been seen on television before, I happened to, just by accident, catch it, because I saw a promo on NBC, and instead of going to Cape Cod for a summer vacation with the rest of my family, I stayed home and was transported in time and space to the Star Trek universe. Well, that was 49 years ago, and an awful lot has happened in that 49 years, and we're kind of planning something big around Star Trek. We're not going to give it away, but in a few days, something really intriguing might appear on the Star Trek horizon, so please kind of stay tuned for that. The other thing I want to talk about at the top of the show, everyone has been sending me emails about something's coming. I got one email from a very serious individual who wanted me to try to begin one of our consciousness experiments in terms of averting the terrible, awful, horrible thing which is coming. At least that's his email. And he wanted me to basically pronounce the September of Joy. I have no problem with the September of Joy, except, as I've said on the show in the last few days, I think what's going on is that there are apprehensions, there are fears, there are latent uncertainties, and all kinds of tremors in the force around things that are out there beyond the horizon that we can hear or see or touch or feel or whatever. But in fact, as someone else pointed out to me a couple nights ago in an email, there is something going on which is so staggering and so important and so kind of overlooked that in fact may be what is causing this subliminal tremor in the force. And that, of course, is this awful, horrible, astonishingly bizarre refugee situation from the Middle East stretching up through Europe. If you have 4 million people from Syria and from Libya, trekking across deserts, you know, drowning in the Mediterranean, all trying to get to a safer place, freedom, whatever, those 4 million people are all coherently thinking the same thing. This is awful. I need to get out. And I'm wondering, per the person who emailed me, if in fact that's not what an awful lot of people have been picking up. I mean, this is the largest migration in modern times, and it's kind of slid in under the radar to where we haven't even noticed, and that's not even discussing the origins, the causes, you know, who's at fault, who's not at fault, who's done stuff, who's not done stuff, all of that. Just 4 million people desperately looking for a life that they can live in peace and harmony and quiet and productivity. That, to me, should cause a major tremor in the force, and probably we're going to get into some of the background and underlying reasons why this is going on right now with my guest this morning. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce my colleague, my friend, and tonight, my guest of the hour, actually of the 2 hours, Peter Lavenda. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to read from Peter's bio, which he wrote in his own words, and I'm going to slip in some other things as it is appropriate, because when you read these things on the air, they're different than when you look at them on paper. So let me start. As Peter says, I am a proud native New Yorker who hails from the Bronx. I grew up in a lot of places in the United States, from the Bronx to Indiana, Illinois, New Hampshire, and back to the Bronx, where I graduated from Christopher Columbus High School, the same alma mater as David Berkowitz and Christine Jorgensen, in 1968. I became involved with the American Orthodox Catholic Church that year, after successfully and dramatically gatecrashing the funeral of Bobby Kennedy at St. Patrick's Cathedral, at which point I came to the attention of the church. There is much more about this church in Sinister Forces, that's obviously one of his books, and on the Sinister Forces blog, if he says if it gets restored, I don't know whether it has been, so we'll ask him in a minute. The church was a front, he found out, from domestic and international intelligence activities, as I later discovered, Peter says. Recently released files from Jim Garrison's office in the case against Clay Shaw have now proven this beyond a reasonable doubt, I am glad to say. He then goes on, I later worked for about a year for Spencer Memorial Church in Brooklyn Heights, where I made the acquaintance of the Black Panthers, the Weathermen, various Irish revolutionary groups, and sundry other characters, including Oscar Brand and Peter Seeger. Obviously, that's several shows back-to-back, so we're not going to go down that road, at least for a time. During the Watergate era, I began researching what would become Sinister Forces. I traveled to Chile in 1979 and was detained in Colonia Dignidad, the notorious torture and interrogation center of the Pinochet regime and his dreaded secret police, the DINA. It has recently been revealed that Colonia Dignidad was not only a safe house for Odessa, but also where weapons of mass destruction, such as chemical and biological agents, were being developed for use by Operation Condor. The story of this is all told in my first book, Unholy Alliance. And then let me skip down, because this is a really interesting part. He says, yes, I have written extensively about subjects as seemingly disparate as esotericism, the Nazis, the Mormons, Freemasonry, Tantra, and Chinese trade, but to me, they are all connected. This, of course, is why we're going to have the conversation tonight. And reading one of my books usually carries over a theme and much connective tissue from one to the others. Since I have done a lot of traveling to something like 40 countries since the early 1970s, I tend to see the world as interconnected, and religions, business practices, politics, and histories all influencing each other and creating a powerful engine that we are forced to call reality, for want of a better term. Mr. Lavenda, welcome to the other side of midnight.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
Okay, where should we start? When we were together in Amsterdam, you told a story to the gathering that night in a roundtable similar to this, and that story so struck me as emblematic of who you are and the mission you're on that I think we should start there. I think you should start by your trip to South America and what unfolded.
Sure, I'd be happy to. This is it was obviously a very formative experience for me. It was a culmination of some research I had been doing, starting, as you mentioned, during the Watergate era. I was researching the influence of religion on politics and politics on religion. This is a kind of bizarre, you know, interest of mine, but it goes back a very long way. And something occurred to me as I was doing the research that I had found out that there existed in Chile, a weird kind of Nazi estate that I had a hard time believing really existed. Ladislas Farrago mentioned it in a book of his called Aftermath. He was a World War II historian. I think he's best known for his book on Patton, as well as Game of the Foxes. And he had written this one story about this one book about what happened after World War II. I mean, he was a World War II historian, but now he moved, you know, to the post-war period. And among many other things, he mentions almost in passing in his book the existence of a place called Colonia Dignidad, and that means the colony of righteousness. And he said it was a Nazi estate, and they practiced weird religious rituals, and it was well armed. There were anti-aircraft guns. There were all kinds of stuff, and it sounded like something, as I frequently say, like something out of a Robert Ludlum novel.
Does not sound like your average hacienda.
Does not. Does not indeed. And this is when I finally decided I would go down there. This was in 1979, at the height of the Pinochet regime. Now, Pinochet had taken over the country from Salvador Allende in a military coup. This was part of the Nixon-Kissinger doctrine, that they wanted to get rid of Salvador Allende, who was a Marxist president. Although he was democratically elected, they decided they had to get rid of him. They helped to organize and finance and support a military coup against Allende, and Pinochet, General Pinochet, was the leader. That happened on September 11th, 1973.
Didn't it wind up that the CIA actually had bombed his car or something?
We can get into that story. The CIA, well, let's fall back a little bit. What happened after the military coup was that a lot of people fled Chile. Some were imprisoned. One of the people who was imprisoned was Orlando Letelier. Letelier was an ambassador under Allende, under the Marxist president, and he was sort of raising consciousness in Europe and in the United States, trying to get people to oppose the regime. What happened was the secret police that you mentioned, DINA, DINA, contracted a hit on this ambassador in Washington, D.C., in our own country.
I remember that. Yes, yes. It was like the car just blew up in the middle of downtown D.C.
Exactly. Right within view of the Chilean embassy. That was the whole point.
Message.
Well, the man who organized this, who planted the bomb in the car, and who had a team of in those days, anti-Castro Cubans working for him, which is, again, the whole Watergate thing, which is how I became sort of very involved in this story, was an American, a man called Michael Vernon Townley. Townley was the son of a Ford Motor Company executive living in Chile, and he was very much involved with the extreme right, some of the neo-Nazi groups in Chile that were opposed to Allende and who were supporting the Pinochet regime. Townley, however, was also the guy who designed the torture and interrogation cells at Colonia Dignidad, the place that I was going to visit. And I didn't know this until much later. But at the time, he was the guy who was designing the electronics for this colony. He's the same guy who blew up the car in Washington, D.C. He's now in witness protection somewhere in the United States, and he has been talking about other projects. He was involved in other assassination attempts and what was really going on at the colony. But in those days, of course, we just knew him through reputation because of the car bomb in Washington.
So in 79, when you decided to make this trek, where were you in your career, and what gave you the crazy idea to try to go and figure this thing out on your own?
Well, I was researching a book, and the book eventually became Sinister Forces. But what was happening was I was looking at the data. I was living in New York City. Of course, I'm from New York, and I lived a lot of places. But at the time, I'm in New York City, and I'm living in an area that has a lot of people from Chile and Argentina and all of that. I'm starting to hear these stories. I read this book by Fargo that says there's this weird colony. And I'm working at the time for an American multinational company, the Bendix Corporation.
Oh, good old Bendix. They were very prominent in, of course, the missions to the moon.
Yes, they were. Missions to the moon, and as well, they were involved with a lot of skullduggery in various parts of the world. While I worked for Bendix in the 1970s, one of our people in Argentina was taken hostage. By, you would call them today, terrorists. They were guerrillas.
This is one of the Bendix folks.
One of the Bendix people, the head of the office there. And at one point, I'm on a telex machine talking to one of our Bendix people in Lebanon at the time of the Civil War, when the telex machine went dead on me from the other side. So we knew there were some problems there in Lebanon. We had a Bendix International, where I worked, was a very strange operation, I can tell you. The international marketing and sales arm of the Bendix Corporation, there's a lot of strange stuff. And when Watergate happened, and they started to report that Bendix was involved politically overseas, training the troops in Saudi Arabia, for instance, and doing a lot of other things around the world, suddenly the shredders started humming in our offices, and a lot of stuff was being destroyed as more and more news was coming out about our involvement in these things. So
now, you did not know when you were working for Bendix that they were deeply involved in all this other stuff, right?
Well, not until I read the New York Times, no. When the New York Times stories came out, that's when I realized, oh boy, this something else is going on here, something very, very strange. I mean, I knew we had a very elite group of people working with us there. I mean, they were people who spoke virtually every language in the face of the earth. They knew, you know, foreign environments very well, foreign cultures, politics, everything very well. It was a very exciting and stimulating place to be. It was like working at Langley, I guess, you know, with a whole bunch of intelligence analysts, basically. Mm-hmm. So it was an interesting environment, but there were moments when I decided I had to do things that were probably not kosher. For instance, in 73, when Allende had been overthrown and the junta was taking over, the military leaders were taking over, we were supplying all sorts of spare parts for their aircraft, for their trucks and other military vehicles and that sort of thing. And I was in a very sensitive area, the telex department, right? So all of the orders that were coming to go out to the various factories to, you know, ship all this stuff to Chile was urgent, you know.
And you were like in the center of the spider web. You could see it all.
I could see it all. And so what I did was I would occasionally misplace a decimal point. So if they were asking for, you know, 100 of something, they got 10. So I was doing my little bit there, you know, as a form of protest, I suppose.
And how old were you at this time?
In September 73, I was 22.
I got the same age when I went to Cronkite. And right. I did some pretty weird stuff, but I didn't do anything like what you're about to tell us you did.
Well, that was just some stuff on the side, you know. I mean, I felt very strongly about the that we shouldn't have overthrown a democratically elected president.
Yeah, there is that nagging thing.
Regardless of his politics, you know. But, you know, we're supposed to stand for these things, and I thought we should have stood for it then, and regardless of the outcome. I mean, they can always have an election later and overthrow him, right? Mm-hmm. But we did it the hard way. So that was a little bit upsetting. But so it's in that environment. When it comes down to 79, I'm still working for Bendix. I'm involved with overseas.
Hello.
I wasn't traveling very much then. And vacation was coming up, and on my own dime, I decided I'm going to go down to Chile. I'm going to look up this colony. I'm going to find out what that's all about, because that would be great for the book. I mean, here's a weird religious cult, which is also a Nazi safe house or something, and, you know, Mengele was supposed to pass through there, and, you know, Klaus Barbie and all these, you know, famous Nazis were supposed to be passing through. Let me go down myself and take a look. This was my very first foray, you know. And, of course, you know, you're at that point I was, this was in June of 79, so I was 28 years old, feeling, you know, invulnerable. I mean, no one could harm me. I would live forever. So I decided to go down and, you know, and check it out.
Okay, so I'm trying to picture this. Is Ford still president, or has Carter been elected?
In 79, Carter is still president.
Oh, Carter. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Yeah, Carter's president. Reagan would come in 80, so that was Carter.
Okay.
So I said, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to see what I can do. So I take the flight to Chile from New York, which is a very long flight. It's like going to Japan. I mean, it's like a 12-hour flight.
Mm.
And I get off the plane, and everything seems to be fine. I get to my hotel. I, you know, wander around the city, and I realize there's something very strange going on in Santiago, Chile. I've never been, as a New Yorker, you know, I've never been in a big city where there's no sound, you know.
What?
You walk down the streets, and no one is talking. There's nobody speaking on the streets. You pass by people and they're utterly quiet. You go into a restaurant, you can place an order with a waiter, but then you realize all the other diners in the restaurant are also silent. Everyone's afraid to talk. They don't know who's listening.
Holy cow.
And the city was under martial law. So there was a curfew and everything else. You had to be in your hotel by, I think it was 10 o'clock at night, if I'm not mistaken, or earlier. So all this stuff is going on. And, you know, you see troops everywhere. And I decided I was going to go and take a picture of their State Department. And, of course, it's surrounded by armed troops with these Wehrmacht-style helmets, right? It looks very strange. It's like you're like in the 1940s suddenly.
I mean, had you expected any of this, or was this kind of a shock?
It was kind of a shock. I mean, it was a shock to see how 1940s, you know, Bavaria, the whole place looked. There's a very strong German presence there. I mean, they really run the businesses in Chile.
And you did not anticipate that either, I take it.
No, I did not. So I'm going to go up to take a picture of some soldiers, and they stop me and they say, no, it's prohibited. I go up to take a picture. There's a military school, like an academy. You know, a training area, which is done in Bavarian style. Looks like a chalet, you know. And I'm going up to take a picture of that, and this young kid, you know, he couldn't have been more than 18 years old, again in the Wehrmacht helmet and the heavy overcoats and everything, points his rifle at me, you know. So I said, okay, I dropped the camera. I mean, it was on a strap around my neck. I drop it. I back away, raise my hands. I'm thinking, Jesus, no one's got a sense of humor around here. Not exactly the tourist capital of the world if you can't take a photograph. So I finally decide, okay, I'm going to go to the colony, which is hours south of Santiago.
Now, did you know roughly where it was, or was it like a shot in the dark and finding someone who would tell you or take you? Or?
Well, I knew where the town was. I knew it was on the outskirts of a town called Parral, which is a number of hours south of Santiago by bus. And I was taking public transportation. As a New Yorker, I had never learned how to drive.
Well, that's a perfect cover.
Well, yes, it is. James Bond, I wasn't. So here I am on public transportation, and I get off at in Parral at 4 o'clock in the morning. On this particular day, I mean, there's in this tiny town, it's dead quiet except for the roosters crowing.
And how could you tell it was dead quiet if it had been dead quiet all around?
Well, yeah. I mean, you get out, and it's still, you know, the spookiest thing that Chile was so quiet in those days. So I got out, and you know, I met by someone who declares he's the night watchman of the town.
So you're on this bus. You just get off in this town at 4 a.m.
4 o'clock in the morning. Yep.
And you're there by yourself. Bus pulls away.
And it's freezing because it's winter. Even though it's June, it's winter down in the south.
Of course. And then this guy appears out of the darkness.
Yeah. He's bicycling. And he has a dog attached to his bicycle. He looked like something out of a Fellini movie. And he sort of bicycles up to me and, you know, asks me who I am and what am I doing there, which was a logical question. Here's this gringo at 4 o'clock standing downtown Parral. And I said, well, I'm waiting to take the train. There's a train station there. And he starts laughing. There hasn't been a train down there in years, right? Mm. So he's laughing and he says, okay, really, why are you here? You know, so I told him I'm going to the colony.
Mm-hmm.
And then he just goes white, and he says, no, you don't want to do that. And then he brings me to see a couple of his friends, and these are carabineros. In those days, the police and the military were the same. There was no separate police department. Everything was under control of the military. So there's two soldiers.
No posse comitatus there.
Nope. And they've got their rifles and their helmets and all the stuff. And I look at my passport and everything else, and they say, okay, let's just, you know, you're not going anywhere right now. It's 4 o'clock in the morning. So we're hanging out, drinking aguardiente, right? We're drinking fire water, you know, a homemade alcohol. And the four of us, there's two cops, there's the night watchman and myself, we're sitting there. And they're starting to tell me stories. And they're saying, you don't want to go to the colony. The colony is very dangerous. We don't like it. We hate them. They're being financed by someone from abroad because they're always getting checks at the local bank and they're always depositing these huge amounts of money.
And they're telling you all this?
We're all getting drunk. So they're telling me all this. You know, it was the beginning of my sales career.
Is a Bond movie.
Yeah, well, at that point it is. And so we're sitting around, and they're telling me all this stuff. And they're saying, really, we recommend you don't go up there. They're not nice people. They're very nasty. We hate them. It's like going to a foreign embassy. You know, their territory is their territory. We can't get in there. We can't you know, people disappear up there, they're telling me.
Were you as drunk as they were, or were you holding your liquor? And
oh, my God, no. I did. I was scared to death of getting drunk in those circumstances. I mean, there's guys with loaded weapons around me. You know, and I'm this kid from the Bronx.
Well, that'll keep you sober.
Oh, yeah. I was extremely
adrenaline
sober.
Adrenaline is a very good anti-whatever, alcoholic something.
Oh, yeah. And I was really pacing myself and trying to appear that I was drinking as heavily as they were.
Ah.
And, now, of course, much as they start drinking, the less they're noticing you.
So. Of course, of course. So at this point, are you saying maybe this wasn't the best idea in the world?
Well, yeah. You know, but I had, you know, I made it this far, and I, you know, by God, I was going to take it the rest of the way. So dawn comes up, the sun comes out. It's now Sunday morning. It's the end of June. And they get up, they have to go back on patrol, and the night watchman has to go to sleep, and I'm saying, okay, fine. I arrange, in front of the church in Parral, there was kind of a taxi service, I mean, a private car kind of thing, gypsy cab, you might say. And I talk to this guy, and I negotiate a deal. I say, I want to go up to Colonia Dignidad. And I said, I just want to go up and come back. I have a camera. I just want to take a picture. I'm not going to hang out. Let's just go and come back. Can you do that? Well, we negotiated this outlandish price. For sure. I mean, it had to be, I don't know, $50. But in those days, it was just a huge amount of money. And we get in the car and we're driving. Now, I knew from the book, from Farrago's book, Aftermath, basically what I was going to see. There's a road going up into the Andes Mountains. There's the Colonia Italiana, which is first, and then Colonia Dignidad. Colonia Italiana obviously is an Italian colony, and you're passing up that way. You pass through, you know, the guys that look like gauchos or, you know, sort of Clint Eastwood, you know, mm-hmm. appearance. They're coming down on horses.
Mm.
You're thinking, oh, this is cool.
And this is dawn, and you got the Andes, and you got the color.
It's beautiful, you know, absolutely. You know, and we're going up this dirt road all the way up. And it's taking us maybe, I don't know, 45 minutes to get up to from Parral downtown, up, if you want to call it downtown, all the way up to the top where the colony is. And we pass through, we drive into a parking area, like a parking lot, and it's very quiet again. There's an open gate. We just drive into the parking lot, and I tell the driver, don't go anywhere, I'll be right back, I'm just going to take a picture, I'm going to come back in. He says, okay, don't worry. I go out. There's a building there.
Like
there's
a guardhouse or a gatehouse?
Like a little bit bigger, yeah, like a gatehouse, you might say, a little bit bigger than that, like maybe a reception area or something. But it's locked, it's closed. But from the other side of the walls or the door, I can hear people talking. So they don't sound happy. So I'm thinking, okay, this is it. I took my pictures. I jumped back in the car. I said, okay, let's go. I figured this is – I've overstayed my minimal welcome. As we as he turns the car around and we're trying to leave, the gate that we had passed through closes in front of us electronically.
Oh, it is a Bond film.
There's the Bond film, yeah. And a white Mercedes pulls out in front of us. I don't know where it came from. Pulls out to block us from ramming the gate if we wanted to. Not that my driver was going to do that, but just to you know, forestall the eventuality. The four doors of the Mercedes open, and the four of the largest human beings I've ever seen in my life get out of this car. Huge men, and they surround the car. And one of them starts asking the driver, how many of them are there?
In Spanish or German?
In Spanish.
Okay.
Because my driver would not have spoken German. He only spoke Spanish, not even English. So they're asking him, okay, how many are there? When did they arrive? Where are they staying? You know, and I'm thinking, what's they? It's me. And then from the other side, on my side of the car, someone knocks on my window. Remember, our windows are rolled up, and it's cold. It's a cold winter morning in Chile. I roll down the window, and, you know, the phrase I've waited my entire life to hear, you know, is spoken to me. This guy with a heavy German accent says, your papers, please.
Oh, my God. Okay, Peter, hold it there. We're going to be right back. My guest this morning is Peter Lavenda, and we're discussing his extraordinary adventure and his extraordinary courage and his extraordinary lack of common sense in going to South America to a stronghold of unknown persons who speak in heavy German accents and ask for your papers, please. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we'll be right back. Guest this morning is Peter Lavenda, and Peter has poised us on the edge of a mental cliff with Papers, Please.
Yeah, that was something that, you know, if you've watched enough World War II films and or Hogan's Heroes or whatever, the term Papers, Please, man, that's something that you never think you're actually going to hear in real life, but there it was.
It's a Bond movie. Come on.
Well, yeah, at that point, it becomes perilously close to one.
So what's going through your mind at this moment? Am I really here? Is this guy really? What have I gotten myself? You know what?
The funniest thing, my mind went into a kind of
overdrive.
All I was doing was thinking, and I wasn't. There was no emotional response. I was sort of lack of affect at that point.
Oh.
I knew that if I actually, you know, got a, really realized what was happening, I would probably freak out. And so I was very calm. I handed them my passport. I didn't see there was going to be any way out of that. They took my passport, which is the strangest thing. They took it and they kept it for, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes or something like that. They kept it for a while. They took it into that building where I heard the voices come out of.
Mm-hmm.
And as they do that, a guy comes out. He starts barking orders at his people, and I kind of sneak a look at him.
In German or Spanish?
In German.
German.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
He's dressed in a military style uniform and a Sam Brown belt, and like a fatigue cap, if you guys know what that is. It's that floppy kind of hat that they wear.
Mm-hmm.
And he's talking to these people who are now coming. They're running from all over the estate, and a guy runs up to me. He's dressed in a blue lab coat, you know, shades of Marathon Man.
Wow.
You know, is it safe? I'm waiting for the guy with the tweezers to pull out my teeth. Anyway, he runs up to the side of the car, and he's the one going to be conducting my interrogation, you might call it, because I refused to dicker for my life in a foreign language, you know. So I could have done this in Spanish. My Spanish was pretty good, but I did not want to do that. I figured, if they're going to do something, I want to do this in English.
Were you at all calculating, like, if I get them on my language, I'll have a better chance?
Yeah, because I'd be able to, you know, spin my web of words a lot easier in Spanish.
Well, you were even then a wordsmith, so.
Oh yeah, I was really a wordsmith that day. I can tell. And it did not impress anyone. But anyway, it did help, I think. So I'm sitting there, and as they're talking to me and asking me, "What are you doing here? Why are you here?"
This is now in the white building. You're out of the car?
No, I'm still in the car. I am not getting out of that car.
Okay.
They want me out of the car. They're going to need a can opener to get me out of that car because I was not leaving.
Good thinking.
And they asked me for my camera though. And they took the film out of my camera, which were my photographs of the estate, and a lot of other photographs, too, I had taken. All that is lost. They hand me back the camera. They're asking me what I'm doing there. I said, well, I'm researching German immigration to South America. That got a big laugh from the leader in the back. He said, yeah, right, in German. is telling these guys, yeah, right, find out how many there are. And as they're asking me questions, I can hear the other guys asking my driver questions.
In Spanish.
In Spanish. And they're saying,
do you understand German?
I understand enough of it. I read it better than I speak it.
But I mean, at that time, were you able to eavesdrop? And did you go to English because you didn't want them to know you could overhear what they're saying?
Well, no. I went to English because, like I said, quite honestly, I didn't want to bargain for my life in Spanish or any foreign language. So I went to English, you know, right away. I figured I'm going to keep this on my level. And anyway, I was dressed, I guess you could tell a gringo, I was dressed in a trench coat. well, it was cold, you know, so I'm in a trench coat.
This sounds like the third man.
Which was not a deliberate thing, but it just happened to be that way. So I'm in a trench coat and a turtleneck sweater. So I look kind of like, you know, I don't know, something they might be afraid of.
Your average spy is what you look like.
I look like a spy, yeah. Sort of stereotype, what can I tell you? So he's, you know, so they're asking my driver in Spanish. My driver didn't speak German, only Spanish. They're asking him, again, how many are there? They told him I was an Israeli commando.
What?
Now, Richard, you've seen me.
Okay? Yeah.
All right. When I was 28 years old, okay, I was a lot thinner and a lot nerdier looking even than I am now. How you would mistake me for an Israeli commando. I would have to be a really good Israeli commando to pull that off. And they said, you know, they have diabolic intentions. I remember that very clearly. They used the word diabolic. They have diabolic intentions. We have to be careful. Nothing against you, they're telling the driver. We're not blaming you for anything. My driver is saying nothing. My driver's hands are on the steering wheel. His knuckles are white. He's staring straight ahead. He thinks he's going to die.
Yeah, of course.
Eventually, they hand me back my passport. And this guy leans into my window, and he says, "Get out of Chile. You're no longer welcome in this country." Okay.
Hmm.
These are a bunch of guys on the top of a mountain in the middle of nowhere, and they're telling me to get out of the whole country.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the gates open, the car goes away, my driver takes off. And it took us maybe 45 minutes to go up the mountain. It must have taken us about 15 to get up. This guy had his pedal to the metal, and he was laughing hysterically.
Okay, let me stop you there.
Yeah.
Let me stop you there. How come you're still alive? Why did they let you go?
I didn't know until I got back to the States. After I got back to the town, to Parral, I'm catching...
I think it's Skype again.
Getting on public transportation. I'm getting the next bus back to Santiago, and as we're going up the highway... the Pan Am Highway, back to the city. It's hours and hours away. The buses stopped periodically at roadblocks that weren't there before. And soldiers get on the bus, and they ask for me by name.
Interesting.
They want to make sure I'm on the bus.
Wow.
I get back to my hotel, and as I get back, there's a note waiting for me in my hotel room that informs me I'm on the next flight out, which is like the following day.
Oh, the friendly German travel agency folks.
Oh, yeah. And it's a flight going to Miami. I didn't want to go to Miami. I wanted to go to New York. But I'm not, you know, beggars are not going to be choosers in this case. And I said, no problem. So I take the flight to Miami. And it's only on that flight that it hits me what's happened, right?
That you basically should not be alive.
Yeah. So I spend half of that flight, I'm not ashamed to say it, in the restroom heaving my guts out.
Oh, boy.
I suddenly realized that, you know, something really, really wrong is going on here. And when I get back to Miami, this is one of these things that can only happen in fiction, but it happened to me. I'm in Miami International Airport waiting for a connecting flight. I had to go and barter my way up into back to New York. And there's the Miami newspaper, the Miami Herald, I guess. And the headline on it is that the German parliament, the Bundestag, extended the statute of limitations on German war crimes that weekend.
Oh.
They were voting in the German parliament whether or not they were going to extend it forever or whether it was going to expire that year. The people at the colony evidently thought I was there to screw with them in some way, right?
Israeli agent.
Yeah, they were so afraid that the vote was going to go against them. They figured, let this guy go.
You would have been a martyr. You would have changed the vote.
Yeah, something. Yeah.
So you're talking to me tonight is basically chance.
Absolutely. Because a couple of years later, another American is hiking in the area, not even that close to the colony. I mean, miles from the colony, but in that general area of Chile. He's picked up by a Chilean military patrol. He's taken to the colony. And he's never heard from again.
Hmm.
They're still looking for him. His family is still looking for him. His name is Boris Weisweiler, and his family has been going straight to the president of Chile, straight to the Supreme Court. All of these things, they're not getting anywhere. They went to the Americans. They, of course, Colin Powell was down talking to the president of Chile. He brought it up. They haven't been able to find anything about this guy. This has been going on for years. I mean, decades now.
Decades.
What happened a couple of years ago, Pinochet is out of power.
Right.
There's a new democratically elected president. One of the first things they do is they raid Colonia Dignidad. They send helicopters. They send half-tracks. They send... it's a military invasion of the colony. The leader, the guy who was screaming at me in the Sam Brown Belt, disappeared over the border into Argentina. They eventually found him. But the people who were still left there were left sort of, you know, holding the bag. The military found huge caches of weapons. They found the interrogation cells, the interrogation, because they were interrogating political prisoners there, as I found out when I got back to the United States. I only found this out later when I got back, but this was a place where they would take political prisoners for torture and interrogation, using some really bizarre systems that Michael Townley had invented, which enabled the interrogator to torture you by remote control. He would be in a sort of glass booth with the controls for several interrogation cells at once, and he would be able to send electrical current to the beds that you were strapped to. These were iron beds, metal beds, and electrocute you, basically, with various degrees of electrical current while he was asking you questions through a microphone. I mean, the whole thing was very bizarre. But they found the interrogation cells, and they found a cache of documents, which has never been released. And I'm fairly certain there's a photocopy of my passport in those documents.
I would bet there is.
And I'd love to see those documents, but the Supreme Court of Chile has denied access to anyone.
Why?
Those documents. Well,
what's their excuse? I mean, what do they say they're doing versus what are they really doing?
Well, these are, you know, it's a national security excuse. And my problem is that I feel that there was some involvement of our country in the events at the colony. Obviously, Michael Townley was operating both in Chile and in the United States with impunity until the assassination of Letelier.
An American passport.
With an American passport. So I'm thinking there might have been some revelations about a Chilean-American, maybe CIA, involvement with this. They're doing the best they can. People like Peter Kornblum and people like that who do this kind of research are trying to get as many documents as possible to show the level of involvement we had with the Pinochet regime. There might be some evidence like that at the colony.
So this was an actual Nazi colony. With obviously great penetration into the government of Chile.
Oh, yes.
And
this was a Nazi colony.
And that's what they're keeping secret, I guess, in these documents, the degree to which Nazis took over Chile.
Well, yeah. On YouTube, people who are interested, they Google Colonia Dignidad on YouTube. What's going to come up is a brilliantly done documentary film in Spanish but with English subtitles. It's about an hour on the colony. And you will not believe the stuff that was going on there. The child abuse was one thing. They were abusing children. The sexual abuse, it was like a Jonestown with, you know, the leader determining who's going to get married with whom, who can have sex with whom, and he was always, you know, using the children for himself. The guy was a despicable guy. But in addition, we find out other things. We find out that, yes, indeed, Joseph Mengele had been there. Yes, indeed, Klaus Barbie, Hans-Ulrich Rudel, Otto Skorzeny, all the big names of the Odessa, of the Nazi underground were there. When children were taken, and they were taken quite often from their families, from the surrounding area, they were, you know, kidnapped, basically, kept at the colony. They were not allowed to speak Spanish. They were taught German. I've seen interviews with young Chilean boys recounting what happened to them at the colony. They had to speak in German. They didn't know Spanish any longer.
And this went on from 45 through the 70s to when did the military invasion of the colony take place?
That didn't take place until the 90s.
So we're talking like half a century, if not more.
Well, the colony was officially founded in 1960. The man who founded it was a Baptist preacher who was a former Luftwaffe medical officer. He had to leave Germany because of child abuse allegations and stuff of that nature. He makes contact with the German community down in that part of Chile, which is very strong, very large. He somehow manages to acquire this huge estate. He has money behind him, no question about it, and sets it up as a safe house for Odessa, for the Nazi underground. And eyewitnesses there have talked about the famous Nazis who passed through. Even my driver, as I was talking to him as we were going up, I'm quizzing him onto, you know, who he thinks, you know, was at the colony. And Mengele was one of the names that came up. And Skorzeny was one of the names that came up.
With all of this swirling around in Chile, because obviously the underground, you know, network is beyond light speed telling everybody what's going on, why did this guy drive you? Why did he agree to drive you up there?
Well, he thought what was going to happen was what I thought was going to happen. Normally, on a Sunday morning, that place would be pretty well locked down. Probably we're going to drive up to the gate. I was going to take a picture of the gate. We'll turn around and come back. That was the idea. We did not expect the gate to be open. That was something that was kind of weird. So we got in, and believe me, I did not spend any time there. I was going to turn around and go right out. So we thought, and for the money, you know, he was willing to do that. Mm-hmm. He got quite a large, you know, amount of cash for this. So this was, you know, what he thought would be fine. It would be okay to go up and come back.
And it was the fact that it was that weekend when the vote in Germany was taking place that caused everything not to be what you expected.
Exactly. Had the vote already happened, I don't know if I'd be here talking to you today. Because there'd be no margin in it for them to let me go.
Particularly if they had, you know, U.S. connections that would quietly keep anything from making the New York Times.
Plus, they were involved, as I said in the bio that you read, they were involved, as I found out again much later, in developing sarin gas and other chemical and biological weapons.
So
I mean, the place was stockpiling.
How did this place figure into a big – because obviously the Nazis were using this as a redoubt to regroup and to plan further strategies. What was their bigger strategy in terms of, you know, this compound and all the weaponry and all the experimentation, et cetera?
Well, this was a node in what was known as Operation Condor. Operation Condor was a kind of a mutual assistance agreement among a lot of Latin American countries, mostly in the south, the Mercosur region, which is Chile, Argentina, Paraguay, Uruguay, an agreement to conduct anti-communist assassinations and terrorist activities, not only in South America, as it turned out, but also in Europe, and as we saw with the Letelier assassination, even in Washington, D.C. This was a kind of pan-Nazi fascist arrangement of personnel. The generals, the leaders of these countries were all deeply involved, and as it turns out, Colonia Dignidad was the sort of telephone network switchboard for the entire operation. Everything went through the colony. They were there for good. They were going to put military regimes in all of these countries, get rid of the communists in Latin America, and then move on. They were committitting assassinations against people they didn't like in Europe.
So were they basically building a foundation for a Fourth Reich?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. You had Klaus Barbie in Bolivia, who then became head of their own secret police, their legitimate secret police of the Bolivian government. Klaus Barbie, the Butcher of Leon, very famous Nazi war criminal, mm-hmm. was actually in charge of the government police.
Okay.
So, I mean, just think about that. I mean, here's a man that the whole world wants, and he's actually running the show in Bolivia. Pinochet was a big, you know, a lover of this sort of stuff in Chile. You had the generals in Argentina. You had generals. You had a fascist thing happening in Brazil. It's just, I mean, Paraguay, of course, under Stroessner, was insane, you know, as far as pro-Nazi activity was concerned. So you had really a lot of this going on in South America at the time. We're talking the 1970s to the 1980s. It was a mess. And it looked like they were going to win, you know, at least near South America was concerned. And as I looked later, as I wrote in other books since then, as I investigated the situation in South America, there were a lot of very prominent Nazis in very prominent positions in virtually every country there. Colombia, Venezuela, Bolivia, Peru, Chile, everywhere. You know, they were trying to establish themselves in that part of the world. And there was very little, if any, interference in their plans coming from the United States.
Hmm. Well, of course, you know, our CIA had enormous Nazi components carefully grafted onto it before, during, and after the war.
Yep.
Okay.
And we know that they helped people like Barbie to escape. You know, they provide. I mean, he worked for us. Klaus Barbie worked for American intelligence in Europe for years. And then he was given the papers and through the rat lines, through the monastery route, and was allowed to go to Bolivia, where he then became head of their secret police.
Amazing, amazing. So this experience, I mean, if you're throwing up in restrooms all the way from Miami to New York, obviously this changed you somehow. How?
Yeah. The important thing I took away from this, I think, that gradually dawned on me, was that this is not all about books and documents. You know, this is about really about reality, that we tend to view reality through through a glass darkly. You know, we tend to see it through the medium of television or something. There's an unreal quality to all of these things that happens. I began to see there's a whole other side to reality. There's a whole other side to the kind of reality that we grow up with, the consensus reality that we all live with, that there's something else at work here. And it can be very, very dark, and it can be very vicious. I mean, seeing what Chile looked like during Pinochet, it was terrible enough. But then seeing the colony, and then knowing later how I basically escaped by the skin of my teeth, how the people at the colony, actually their fingers stretched all the way into the government of Chile, that this was all interrelated and interconnected. This is something that, you know, if all you're doing is kind of the internet-style journalism, you know, where you sort of Google stuff and then you write about it, it's one thing. Mm-hmm. But when you actually face down the barrel of a gun, and when people are looking at you and they want to kill you, suddenly, you know, it changes your point of view about things. And it makes you more aware. And it makes you want to dig deeper. It makes you want to find out what's really going on. And you always have these experiences. There have been others like that, but you've always had these experiences in the back of your mind that say, okay, just take it one more step. Go there if you have to. Find out what's really taking place here, because there's something going on underneath, you know, our televised mainstream reality. There's something else that's taking place, and it's really real, and yet most people would not believe it if, you know, unless it happened to them.
Well, I find it intriguing that this really was a turning point in your life, and you realized that this was not academic, this was reality. Because I've come at this from a totally different direction, and that's kind of where I wound up. There's so much connected under the surface, like an iceberg, that 99.99% of people ignore, either because they're basically ignorant, which is no crime, or they want to be ignorant because it's better for them psychologically. They can't handle the truth, and the truth is very, very messy. Let me move radically to a whole different perspective. In your bio, you talk about being kind of a marked man by the church. Can you limb out why that situation suddenly came about and how that's folded into the rest of your experience?
Yeah, well, that was sort of the beginning of this whole process of realization. And a lot of it didn't even occur to me. Or I didn't realize it until later, when I actually saw documents and I realized the documents I was looking at was really about my life. Back in...
Are we talking literally or metaphorically?
I would say more towards the literal than the metaphoric, and I'll show you how.
Okay.
What happened was, in the late 1960s, of course, we had Vietnam. I was a high school student. I was turning 18 in 1968, the year of the Tet Offensive and all the assassinations and the Democratic National Committee and all that stuff was going on. And a friend of mine and I, we're asking ourselves, you know, if we don't go to college and we don't maintain a certain average in college, we're going to the draft.
Yeah.
We'll wind up in the tall grass. What are we going to do about that? And what are our options? And the only options were, like, you know, the 4F deferment, you know, if you're physically, you know, incapable or whatever, or, you know, you pretend to be gay or something. I don't know. You know, we're sort of looking at these options.
And conscientious objector was not on the list?
We thought that was going to be really hard to maintain. a conscientious objector status. You know, we were actually thinking, you know, Sweden, Canada, something like that. We didn't know. We were kids. We were 17 at this point, 16, 17, and we're just thinking, well, what are our options? What are we going to do? Something that's, you know, conscientious objector, they would send you somewhere. You would still have to work for the government in some capacity, was the problem. You didn't get off the hook completely. They would send you to do something in a non-combatant role, but you would still be working for the government for a couple of years. So I hit upon the idea because I'm looking at all the deferments, and I'm saying, look at this. There's a 4D deferment, and it means clerical. And I knew that didn't mean secretarial work. The clerical deferment was a deferment they gave to clergy. My friend was a freak about clerical stuff. So he had, you know, I don't know, it's a long story about him, but he lived near what would become Co-op City in the Bronx. He had a closet full of vestments, you know, Roman Catholic chasubles and stuff like that, clerical collars, all of these things, because he was just fascinated by it. I think he tried to get involved with the Third Order Franciscans, if anybody knows what that is. There's all this other church stuff, and he would spend money and he would buy sort of a chalice or a monstrance or something. He had this bizarre.
It was kind of like cosplay before that term became.
Exactly.
Okay. There you go.
So, and he had friends who were involved sort of in the church in a sort of auxiliary way. Some of our friends were involved in yoga stuff when it was just coming out, and, you know, all this meditation things, all this 1960s stuff. So there was all of that going on. This is New York in the 60s, man. So it's like everything is happening. And
very Beatles and the Maharishi.
Absolutely. That's all going on then. So we're looking at all this stuff, and, you know, I said to him, actually, our own church, right? Because the clerical deferment meant we'd have to actually become a priest in somebody else's church, probably the Catholic Church, since we were both Catholics. And we didn't want to do that. We didn't want to go to seminary. What's the difference between the seminary and the military? We were not sure. So, you know, really? Is that really your only option? And I said, you know, under American law, you can just incorporate a church and you're a church. You know, look at the Universal Life Church. Everybody joined that thing, right?
Oh, how intriguing.
Remember that?
Yeah,
so,
of course.
So we sat and said, let's do this. Let's see if we can do something like this. And I looked into it. This was an idea that I came up with because I had been thinking about this a lot. And I said, okay, the problem is we're too young to sign any legal documents, you know. So we had to get like, you know, a teacher that we knew who was sympathetic, and somebody's parents, I forget which one of us did that, and we signed the documents. We created a church, an Orthodox church, an Eastern Orthodox church, because we were people from Eastern Europe. My father's parents came from Slovakia. His came from the Czech Republic and the Slovakia, both sides. And so we said, let's make a Czechoslovakian Orthodox church, because there isn't one. In the United States, we're filling a need, you know.
Okay, hold it there. We're at the top of the hour. My guest this morning is Peter Lavenda, very alive and healthy and well Peter Lavenda, who has obviously benefits from experience and maybe never put himself in that first situation again. Now he's forming a church, and we'll find out what that leads to right after we come back on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we'll be right back. On the other side of midnight, and we're back with Peter Lavenda. Okay, so you're starting a church.
Yeah. I mean, that's what, you know, 17-year-olds do. Or at least they did back in the 60s. So we do, to make a long story short, we do form a church. Legally, we incorporate it. And, we have, like I say, the vestments and stuff. Some of it's pretty much homemade. But it looks okay. It's passable. And we figure we'll start, you know, on Sundays at least, doing church stuff and see what we can do with the draft board with Selective Service to make sure we get the deferment.
This is hysterical. So do you have to create a liturgy and a whole, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was my thing. So I was able to take existing Orthodox liturgy, like Russian Orthodox and like that, and sort of look at that, look at the originals, and kind of create basically our own specific liturgy, you know, which is the typical Orthodox liturgy. It's like a 2-hour, 3-hour long thing, you know, with the chanting and the incense and the it's not an easy thing to accomplish.
Well, I don't know whether you know this, Peter, but I also used to be a Roman Catholic, so I know exactly what that should have looked like.
Well, this is even more extreme than the Catholic version of the Mass, which in those days was about 45 minutes long. The Orthodox version...
It just seemed like two hours.
Ours would run typically 2 to 3 hours long.
Wow.
So there was, you know, procession with the Book of Gospels. There was all the incense going on. This is an elaborate thing.
Oh, my God. This is... I've never heard this story.
Oh, it's incredible. If you have to go, it's like Dr. Zhivago, that kind of stuff. You know, or Zorba the Greek, those hats, those veils, you know, the robes, the incense, the chanting, everything is sung, nothing is spoken, and we did it in Church Slavonic, mind you. We didn't do it in English, so we taught ourselves Church Slavonic, which is an artificial language created by some saints, and you know, when they were trying to convert Russia. So it's not even a real language, but it has, you know, it has an alphabet and it has, you know, pronunciation and, you know, vocabulary and stuff. So we taught ourselves, you know, basically how to pray in that. And we were, you know, carrying this off pretty well for a couple of kids who look more like nuns than we look like priests. But so what happened was we gate crashed Bobby Kennedy's funeral to make a loan.
That's the backstory on the.
That's
the
backstory.
I wanted to sell the Kennedy thing and I wanted to know, why did the church get you in their gun sights?
Yeah.
Metaphor not included. And this, of course, okay, so go ahead. How did you wind up crashing the Kennedy funeral?
Well, I was a very child of the 60s, and to me, Bobby Kennedy was, you know, was all that.
Of course.
And when he was assassinated, it was, you know, a terrible blow. And it turned out that his funeral was going to be held in New York City at St. Pat's. And, of course, I knew St. Patrick's very well, so did my friend. And it was his suggestion. He said, you know, let's go down there. The night before, let's just walk in and see what happens, you know, bless the casket and leave. So we dressed up in our finest, you know, Orthodox regalia, and we went down on the subway to St. Patrick's Cathedral from the Bronx. We got out, we went through, and the place was very quiet. It was almost deserted, but there was a bishop of some kind, like an MC sort of guy walking around, and he kind of understood that we were Orthodox clergy of some kind,
mm-hmm.
and he let us go in to bless the casket, and there's Jackie and Rose Kennedy.
Oh my.
And they're kneeling next to the casket.
Oh my.
I'm feeling a little, you know, bizarre.
Yeah.
I mean, I wanted to pay my respects to Bobby, but not necessarily in such a way. But we did. We blessed the casket. We said a few prayers and we left. Okay, end of story. Until, as we're going back up the Bronx in the subway, my friend says to me, "Now we're going to the funeral." And I said, "How are you going to manage that? This is the tightest security New York City has ever known.
Mm-hmm.
They just assassinated another Kennedy. Everybody in the government's going to be there. This is a massive undertaking. There's no way we're going to, you know." He said, let's just try. He said, "Let's try it anyway." It was a Sunday. And we hired a limo. It cost like $17, as I recall, to get a limo from the Bronx to St. Patrick's Cathedral. And so we get in the limo, we take it down there, and lo and behold, nobody stops a limo.
Of course not.
You know, a limo pulls up next to the church, no problem. The police wave us through, right? All the security is for nothing. There's a couple of high school kids in a limo.
Amazing.
It could be their prom, right?
Amazing. Another Bond film here.
Another Bond. We get out of the limo. And right away, we're surrounded by Secret Service, who are not blocking us. They're escorting us into the church. I pass by Roosevelt Greer, the guy who manhandled Sir Anser.
Rosie Greer, the football
Rosie
guy.
Rosie Greer, yeah. He's standing there. You know, people that I don't recognize that I probably should have recognized are standing around. The Secret Service guy says, "Okay, come with me," you know. And he leads us into the church, and he turns around and looks at me, and he says, "Russian Orthodox representatives?" And I say in my best heavy Russian accent that I could manage, No, Slavonic Orthodox representatives.
Oh, good.
So, and my friend who's with me is pretending not to speak English at all.
Good.
Which is was my suggestion.
Well, no single point. Yeah, in other words, if you have two people babbling, they might give it away.
Exactly. So we get into the church, and I'm thinking we're going to sit in the back someplace inconspicuous and then maybe, you know, beat a retreat as soon as we can.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't do that.
Oh, no, they want to put you up front.
We're up front.
Ah.
We're up front. We're in the sanctuary. We're with all the other clergy. We're the last ones in. We take our places on either side of the altar. He's on one side, I'm on the other. We're staring at each other like, oh, God, now what? Because now there are all these other clergy. They're all bishops, archbishops, cardinals, whatever. They're staring at us like, who the hell are you? But they can't say anything because now the service has begun. And Andy Williams is standing behind me. He's supposed to sing the Battle Hymn of the Republic at some point. He taps me on the shoulder and asks me if he's on yet. You know, I don't know what to tell this guy. You know, I'm quaking in my boots here. And so we go through the whole service without a problem. And because we're the last ones in, we're the first ones out. We have to lead the procession out of the cathedral.
Oh, God.
I was not in for this, but we have to do it. So my friend is on one side of the casket. I'm on the other.
There has to
Andy
be video
Williams,
of this. We have to see one. There has to be TV of this.
There has to be. I've been looking for it.
It was wall-to-wall coverage. You obviously sat through Teddy Kennedy's incredible quotation from his brother.
Absolutely. I sat through that. It was, you know, it was very, very moving. The whole thing was very moving. I mean, the doors of St. Patrick's Cathedral swing open, you know, as Leonard Bernstein is upstairs conducting the Hallelujah Chorus. I see Atlas from Rockefeller Center, you know, the guy holding up the world.
Yeah.
He's there in front of me. I'm thinking to myself, I'm not going to my high school graduation. This is graduation. You know? And I didn't. I didn't go. I blew that off. So I'm going down. My friend is going down. I'm walking way too fast. One of the other priests tells me to slow down because I was trying to get the hell out
of course.
And so I'm trying to be stately about it. And this is a long way of intro by saying that as we left, as we got out, a lot of other little weird things happened. But one of the things that did happen was that a priest, a bishop actually, who could not get into the church, a weird-looking guy, hands us this piece of paper, this flyer, and he says, you have to come and see us. And it turns out this is the American Orthodox Catholic Church, and it's located in the Bronx, near the Bronx Zoo, appropriately enough. And he says, come on and come and see us sometime. So my friend and I said, okay, let's do that. So one day we go up there and we visit this church. And long story short, we join the church. We get reconsecrated, reordained, all this kind of stuff.
You're legitimate.
Yeah, in a manner of speaking. More legitimate anyway than we were before. And what I don't realize, I mean...
Is this the same day as the funeral, or is this...
Oh, no. We went like a couple of weeks later, week or so later.
Okay.
Yeah. On a Sunday, appropriately. So we went in, you know, and we go to a church. We walk into this place, and there's nobody there except the clergy. There are no parishioners. There's no people in the pews. And, well, we don't have any people either, so we didn't think anything of it at the moment. But there is something weird. The head
Talk
of the
about church, the pretenders leading the pretenders.
Oh, God, it got worse and worse. So this guy who runs the church is a Ukrainian. He's from formerly the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. Now he has his own operation. And he boasts to me, to everybody, that he's got one CIA agent and one FBI agent on his board of directors of his church. Now I'm thinking that's just, you know, making stuff up, right?
And you're 18.
I'm 18. Well, not even 18. No, I'll be 18 that year. Yeah,
okay.
Later on that year. I'm still a high school senior, you know. We both are, my friend and I. So we're there, and, you know, we hear all these stories, and, you know, there are strange guys showing up as we start to get involved with the church. There are strange people showing up in wingtips and black suits, you know, who go and talk to the guy privately and all this. But I'm not really paying that much attention to it. You know, I'm more involved because I kind of have to. But on the other side, I'm really very involved in the spirituality aspect of all of this because I'm very interested in that, esoterica and stuff at that age.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading a lot of books on the subject, on magic, on all this other stuff. I was very, very involved in it. So I'm looking at this whole thing as somehow all related. So my focus is a little bit somewhere else. It's not on politics. A lot of strange things happen in that church while I was there. And I'm going to make, like I say, a long story short. Eventually, I left the church. A lot of very strange circumstances went on, which would take an entire show to talk about. But years and years later, I'm researching the Kennedy assassination, the Jack Kennedy assassination. And I get a hold of, you know, documents from the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And I'm reading some of the FBI reports of interrogations. And I find out they're talking about David Ferry and Jack Martin. And some guy called Carl Stanley in Kentucky, who was a bishop of some kind. And I'm reading with disbelief that this is the American Orthodox Catholic Church they're talking about. Now I'm starting to freak out, and I'm thinking, nah, it can't be the same place, you know. So I start to dig around, do more research, and finally Jim Garrison's papers are released. And in Jim Garrison's papers, there's a letter from the Ukrainian guy to him, dated only a couple of months before I joined his church. He's asking Jim Garrison to release Jack Martin and send him back to the church. And it's on the same letterhead I used to type on. You know, everything is the same. And I'm thinking, oh my God.
Hmm.
And the research I had led up to that point led me to a couple of bishops who were still alive at the time. I visited some of them. I talked to them about this very openly. I wanted to know what was going on. And they said, yeah, the American Orthodox Catholic Church was a front for Hoover. It was an FBI front. They were running ops. That's why you didn't need, you know, they didn't need a congregation. They didn't want a congregation. They were, David Ferry was part of this operation. Jack Martin stayed in this church until he died. I have photographs of Jack Martin wearing clerical garb, the same Jack Martin who was played by Jack Lemmon in the film JFK.
Right.
Right? The same guy dressed as a priest, you know, with a cross around his neck and all of that.
Wow.
He was consecrating bishops long after the Garrison probe. And I talked to bishops who knew him, and they said, you know, Jack Martin was plugged in. You wanted to know anything about anybody, he would get you their FBI file. He knew exactly who was who and what was what.
When life imitates art.
Yeah. So that's what was going on. That's how I got involved with the church. And luckily for me, while I was still with the American Orthodox Catholic Church, I did get my 4D deferment. After all that.
Oh my!
I was taken down to the office, the headquarters of Selective Service in New York in the Federal Building. And there was a very nice man there called Colonel Kirschenbaum. Never forget his name. Very important man. He was kind of a Alan Dulles type. He had patched elbows and that sort of thing and a pipe and, you know, the whole
night.
And he was the head of Selective Service. And he said, sure, you know, unless you want to be a chaplain in Vietnam, we can arrange that too. Ha, 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 ha. Very funny, Colonel Kirschenbaum.
Mm-hmm.
So,
now, was he aware of the con, or was he dealing with this just like you're a member of a real church?
His interest was simple. He said to me, you know, the Eastern Orthodox churches are a hotbed of communist intrigue. They're all headquartered in Eastern European countries. They're sending agents over. The Russian Orthodox Church was definitely sending KGB agents over during that time, posing as priests, dressed as priests. He said, we want you to keep an eye on things. Keep an eye on things, and, you know, if you see anything, you know, interesting, report back to us, but here's your deferment. So it was the understanding was that it was a quid pro quo of some kind. And when I got into a contretemps with the American Orthodox Catholic Church, when I got into kind of a disagreement with them over all of this, they yanked my 4D deferment. I got a letter almost immediately. So they knew everything that was going on. And then I wrote them a letter back saying, you yank it, I'm talking. And they reinstated it. I never heard from them again.
Again, why are you still alive?
Don't know. Because I'm a nice guy.
Okay, this is a build-up to a big question I wanted to ask this evening, and that is, what is your perspective on Pope Francis coming to the United States in a few days?
Well, it's, you know, it's pretty outstanding for a lot of reasons. I mean, this is a very different pope, and I'm glad to see it, because while I was involved with these various churches, real and imaginary, we did have a lot of contact with Catholic Church and Catholic clergymen and with Catholic organizations. And one of the things that I found out was that they were, the people that I ran into anyway, turned out to be pretty much as crooked as everybody else. I mean, it was a very disheartening period when I finally extricated myself from the churches, because I realized it was all politics. It was all corruption, you know, at least everything that I had seen.
A 2,000-year-old bureaucracy, like what would you expect?
What would you expect, really? So that's all I saw. I didn't see, I mean, I heard horrible jokes that priests were telling about each other, about the cardinals, about everything else. I mean, really sick stuff was going on. And I'm thinking, you know,
Was the sexual perversion stuff kind of bubbling underneath?
Oh, it wasn't bubbling. It was open. I mean, they'd openly discussed it. They said that when you went to seminary, you only had two tracks. I mean, you either went with the jocks and you were playing basketball until 3 o'clock in the morning, or you were with the gay clergy, right? Hmm. I mean, it just broke down in these two directions. They told you this openly, the Catholics, you know, and they would make jokes about it and everything else. There was no, you know, the child abuse thing, we all knew about this. This was something that we knew was going on. You know, we heard stories about it all the time. You know, and even the guy at the American Orthodox Catholic Church, the Ukrainian guy, Profeta. I mean, I don't really know all that was going on there. I don't think he was a pedophile of any kind. I'm not saying that, but there were sexual irregularities going on there, and with some of the other bishops as well. It was a hotbed of this kind of stuff. I mean, the wandering bishops, as we called them, the ones who were not quite legitimate, as well as the very stable, you know, Catholic clergy, there was always something going on. We just knew that. You know, but in those days, nobody talked about it. It was kind of a thing you didn't acknowledge. So with Pope Francis coming here, maybe he's going to shake things up. Maybe he's going to lay down the law a little bit. I don't know. You know, he seems to want to do the right thing. So, you know, I've got my fingers crossed on that score, but...
Well, yeah. You're obviously aware of the rather remarkable role the Jesuits have played in church history all over the world, particularly in the Far East, China, all that.
Oh, yeah.
How do you square the Jesuit background, given that propaganda, the spin, with the guy that we seem to be seeing, which to me is very different than one would expect?
Yeah, well, the Jesuit stuff, you know, the Jesuits are at... On the one hand, they're the intellectual force of the church.
Mm-hmm.
They're the most educated branch. I mean, they're all doctors and lawyers and everything else. But on the other hand, as you say, the head of the Jesuits is referred to as the Black Pope for a reason. These guys are extremely powerful, and they've been involved in a lot of political machinations all around the world. They're basically shock troops. At least they were until Opus Dei kind of tried to take that over for themselves. But these are really the shock troops of the church. These are the people you want to send into dangerous places to whip people into shape and to do things they're supposed to do. So that's been their legacy for so long. I've met Jesuits. I've dealt with them. Some are very nice guys. They're very funny. They're very witty. They're very intelligent. But others are true believers. You know. With all that implies.
As in any organization, don't you have like it's almost like seraphims and cherubims, and you're one of the few people that know what I'm talking about when I say that?
Yeah, yeah.
So is there a pecking order where the really deep, dark stuff is like in the center, and the novitiates and the new joiners and all that, they're honest, they're naive, they're inspired, they're idealistic, and then some of those get converted as they find out what's really beneath the surface?
Sure. The church is very good at selecting the people they need for the jobs that are required. So they know exactly who to go to. But there's also cabals within the church. I mean, there was a very strong cabal during World War II that was very pro-Nazi.
Mm.
Okay. There was, I mean, openly, unashamedly pro-Nazi.
I want to go back to your American Orthodox guy, the Ukrainian, because there's a huge fascist undercurrent in the Ukraine. Was he actually of that?
Oh, 100%. 100%. He was very involved with the extreme right in this country, as well as with the extreme anti-communist, pro-Nazi, pro-fascist underground. He was very involved with that, which is why he got along with Hoover and, you know, wanted to use his church as the vehicle. Remember, in those days, it was an innocent time. If you were dressed as a priest, nobody...
Question.
Bothered you. Nobody.
No.
Yeah, everybody trusted you. You were dressed as a priest.
You could get into Bobby Kennedy's funeral.
Exactly. Exactly. It was an innocent time. Wow. So if you wanted to go and visit somebody in the hospital who maybe was recovering a little too fast and maybe push him in the other direction, a Catholic priest, nobody would stop him at 2 o'clock in the morning. He could wander into a hospital room because that's what priests did. They didn't have to worry about visiting hours.
I've seen that movie.
Yeah. So this is something that was going on. And this guy, Profeta, was at the heart of an operation like this. He had David Ferry and Jack Martin working for him.
So, all right, that leads to my next question, which is, are you of the opinion of some of my other friends and colleagues that it's really the Nazis that killed Kennedy?
In a sense, you know, because if we pare this down, parse it down too carefully, if we try to make a lot of little boxes out of it, we're going to lose the overall picture. You know, there was a Nazi element in this for sure, and it's something that I always come across and I can never understand it. You know, it's one of these things that I try to wrap my head around. I wrote about in Hitler Legacy that Lee Harvey Oswald, of all people, you know, was planning to go to this weird little university in Switzerland that no one had ever heard of, called the Albert Schweitzer College, in a small town in the Alps. Okay, no one knows how he even heard of this, because this school did not advertise in your normal, you know, areas. And this is long before the internet. So there was no way for him to even know about this unless he was gently led in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
He applies to go to this university because he wants to learn German, which is a ridiculous reason to go to this university. But anyway, that's his reason. He gets accepted. Lee Harvey Oswald, who was not really a great scholar, gets accepted to go to this university to learn German. He's on his way to go to that university when suddenly he takes the detour and winds up in Moscow, and the rest is history. But looking in his address book and his notebook, he has all this German vocabulary he was writing down, and he had the address of the American Nazi Party in Queens, New York at the time, the headquarters. He had the name of Dan Burroughs written in his address book. He really knew who the Nazis were in the United States. And then I find out, and this I found out a couple of years ago, that a very prominent Nazi, a member of Odessa, a guy who was on friendly terms with Otto Skorzeny, Hans Ulrich Rudel, all these guys.
Skorzeny's the guy who rescued Mussolini?
Yeah.
Okay.
And he's the guy, the Scarface Skorzeny. He's the guy who eventually then became the figurehead for the underground Nazi networks that I refer to as Odessa. He was on very good terms with him. A man called H. Keith Thompson. And H. Keith Thompson was a member of the German Secret Service, the SD, just before World War II broke out, just before we entered the war. He was an American citizen. Just before we entered the war, he was a member of the SD, proud of it. During the war, somehow he's with our military. After the war, he's at Operation High Jump in the Antarctic.
What?
Another whole thing.
That's a huge...
It's a huge thing.
Yeah. Obviously, the next time you come on, we'll talk about that, because I've been incredibly fascinated by the whole Antarctic thing and, you know, the Admiral and the whole Masonic overlay. I mean, what's his name? Who's the guy I'm thinking of?
Bird.
He actually, I'm going to use the wrong term here, he consecrated a Masonic lodge on the South Pole, on the ice cap, or just off on the ship. What was that all, you know, well, that's a whole other set of...
let's go to that
Some other time. So,
but he comes back from Operation High Jump, right?
Mm-hmm.
Kennedy is assassinated. And then suddenly, Lee Harvey Oswald's mother, Marguerite Oswald, now has a literary agent, and this literary agent is H. Keith Thompson, a member of the Nazi underground, a guy who was a member of the German secret police, the secret service, rather, Sicherheitsdienst, a man who was very involved with the Nazis before and after the war, who maintained excellent connections with all of the Nazis still in Europe, as well as those in South America and in North America. Here's a guy in the middle of all of this, and somehow he turns up on Marguerite's doorstep and becomes her literary executor, or Lee Oswald's literary executor. And a couple of, about a year or so ago, I come across on the internet doing my research, and I find that someone's been auctioning off Lee Harvey Oswald's personal effects, auctioning it stuff that should be in the National Archives, you know, for all of us to have access to.
Right.
The letter that he wrote to the Albert Schweitzer College, the letter of acceptance that he got back, all kinds of other stuff like that goes up for sale, and somebody bought it. I mean, before I was even aware that there was a sale. So, I mean, all of this stuff is going on, and Keith Thompson's behind it, and Keith Thompson was a real Nazi, you know, a bona fide Nazi, a proud Nazi, an unapologetic Nazi. So what's he doing with Oswald?
Mm. And Oswald, remember, was supposed to be a communist.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So, I mean, oh, what a tangled web we weave.
Yeah.
When first we practice to deceive.
That was David Ferry's line in JFK.
Which only goes to show we need more practice.
That's right, yeah. Wow. It's astonishing stuff, you know.
Well, it's a background tapestry, because I'm looking at the Pope coming here, and I'm looking at this kind of apprehension in the
yep.
new sphere, in the ether, in the torsion field, that something horrible is coming, and I'm thinking, wait a minute. Since we as humans always respond to any change as horrible, is it possible the Pope is coming to be part of something totally in the opposite direction, and we're just getting the tremors and the force that make us think it's going to be awful, because it's going to be awfully disconcerting?
Oh, yeah. I think there's going to be something disconcerting with this Pope. I mean, he's not going to just pass through and say, hi, how are you? There's going to be, he's going to say something that's going to, you know, cause some tremors, I'm sure. But I don't think it's going to be anything necessarily that earth-shattering, but we're going to look at it maybe months from now and realize that it was earth-shattering, that it was something very important.
Okay, we'll hold it right there. We're at the bottom of the hour. You're on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning is Peter Lavenda, and we'll be back in a flash.
Red is the passion our great country was built on. Black and white, yellow and brown, a nation under God. White the purity of love, like a bride and a groom. We'll always stand united, we will not be divided. There's too much to lose. Blue are the waters surrounding the brave patriots from sea to shining sea. Red the blood of innocence, volunteers wearing the cross, unselfish courage of fighters charging in, and now they're lost.
And we're back on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning is Peter Lavenda, who obviously is keeping us spellbound and riveted in any other cliche you want to use, because you're not making this stuff up. I mean, to have the cojones to do what you did with Kennedy gives us a backstory now, a kind of a view as to how you had the gall to go to South America. I mean, that it kind of all fits together. This is who you are, Peter. So let me now take us to another mystery. If you go to, everyone out there, go to othersideofmidnight.com, othersideofmidnight.com, and click on Peter's name, and that will take you to his page tonight. And at the very top, under Radio with Pictures, there is a picture. Click on that. That takes you to a link of perhaps one of the most remarkable, and I think unfoldingly remarkable, stories that we can see, which is the story of this Nazi gold train. Peter, what the hell is going on with this?
Well, we knew. I mean, I've been doing this Nazi research, as you know, for a long time. I mean, since the 70s. So it started with looking for physical Nazis, and then it went on to the Nazi treasures, the Nazi gold artworks, other things they've been smuggling, weaponry and that sort of thing. And eventually came around to an understanding. During the Clinton administration, there was this idea that they would try to find out what happened to all the Nazi gold. So there was a special commission that was set up to look for it. And basically, they were a bunch of looking at documents, looking at papers, trying to build a picture of, you know, where the how much gold was there and where did it wind up. And they realized they didn't have a clue. I mean, they had good documentation on some of the missing gold that had been taken, not just from the Jews in the death camps, but also from banks through all the occupied territories. And they started putting this together and realized that there was a lot of gold that was still missing. We knew, in general, researchers knew, that there were at least two trains full of artwork and gold that appear to have been missing at the end of the war, that nobody seems to know what happened. Most people kind of assumed that what happened was, you know, it went into one of the, it went into Eastern Europe. Maybe the Russians got a hold of it in the occupied, in the territories occupied by the Soviets, or some of it got out, you know, through seaports and everything else that were not under watch at the time. We don't know. But the United States and the British had put up some, created something called Safe Haven, where they were trying to find all of these assets and freeze them before it could finance a Fourth Reich. But some of the stuff was missing. We know, for instance, that 40 tons of gold, we just found out back in the 90s, 40 tons of gold left Portugal at the end of the war and wound up in Macau, which was a Portuguese colony at that time in China. Mm-hmm. Of those 40 tons, 20 tons went into China. We don't know what happened to those. If they went to Chiang Kai-shek, we're not sure. The other 20 tons went to Indonesia, which is part of a story I've been following for a couple of years now. So you had disbursements of gold all over the place, and it turns out that 40 tons was really a drop in the bucket concerning, you know, what everything else they took. And it's not just gold, it's also artwork, statues, it's manuscripts, books, all sorts of things.
Well, it's the whatever living, it's the Monuments Men story.
Exactly. And at least two trains are missing, and these guys in Poland claim they found one of them. Now, it kind of looks legitimate to me and to a lot of people. I mean, it's very controversial. People are trying to say it's not true.
Well, but kind of walk us through the story, because I have kind of paid peripheral attention. You know, I've had no time to do anything else but this damn show. Sorry, folks, I don't really feel that way. But, you know, I used to do research. I used to actually do digging, you know. Didn't go and try to invade Nazi compounds, but I've done some research in my time anyway. So I've had no time to really focus, but something about this said to me, wait a minute. It's in the right place, in the era.
Sure.
Is it possible that it's part of a timed release? In other words, it's time for this story to come out because of what it will then trigger, including pulling back the curtain on Kammler and the black ops research R&D that was going on in that part of the of Europe at that time.
Well, this is very suspicious timing because this is this year, after all,
this
is the 70th anniversary. Oh, no, no, this is the 70th anniversary of the end of the war. You know, there's enough distance now between, you know, the World War II and the present, and a lot of different things are happening in the Middle East that causes us to go back and review all of that material as well. Something is coming together to explain to us something that happened. You know, if you look at it in a sort of a cosmic way,
I'm looking at things.
Well, today is the gold train, but only a few months ago it was that underground, you know, complex that was discovered in Austria.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Why, after 70 years, suddenly we find a train and we find the 75-acre underground complex in Austria? It took us 70 years to find this?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, well, and they're both happening at the same time.
Let me give you another example of where I think the system is rigged. A couple of days ago, there was a major story about a couple of miles from Stonehenge, English Heritage has found underground with ground-penetrating radar a monument to dwarf Stonehenge with 90-plus stones, geometry, organization, all buried, kind of looking to me like deliberately buried to save it like Göbekli Tepe, and suddenly it's coming to the surface metaphorically, and if English Heritage agrees, they'll probably start digging, and it's all in the same time frame. But to me, it's like, okay, who has this big calendar or clock and says, okay, now it's time to pull this string, and this will happen if we reveal this stuff?
Sure. I mean, it's so suggestive of something deeper that's happening, you know, in our reality. And this is something that, you know, you sound crazy when you say things like this sometimes. You know, I know because I get it all the time. Hmm. But, you know, if you've lived through this, if you've lived through the mysteries being revealed, if you've lived through the secrecy and you've seen it with your own eyes, you've seen what goes on, then you sit back and nothing really surprises you anymore because, you know that expecting, you know. Mm. Everyone's pretty much forgotten. Well, except for the History Channel. Everybody's forgotten about World War II.
Yep.
So, I mean, it's one of those things where it's, you know.
Although, if we're going to do a show on the Marvel Universe. Have mm-hmm. you noticed the comics and the films, the contemporary films, are harking back to the idea of Nazi overlords planning to basically take over the 21st century, coming out of hiding, out of deep cover, out of long-term plans, and suddenly our major tentpole films are filled with Nazis and Hydras and all this stuff that really harkens back to the reality that was set in motion, you know, almost, three-quarters of a century ago.
Yeah. I think what's happening, in a way, is we've gotten distance from the Holocaust. The Holocaust was blinding us to everything else. I'm not trying to devalue.
I understand it. Well, look, how can you look past the Holocaust?
Well, right. That's what's so hard. But in order to find out what's going on in the Middle East today, in order to find out what's going on in Europe and everywhere else around the world, you have to put that on one side because of the evil that it is and look very calmly and coldly at what the Nazis did other than the Holocaust, which was just as despicable, and yet we took our eye off that particular ball. I've been writing about this now for decades.
Okay, let me stop you there again, because I just noticed before I was, going to do the show, I'm prepping, because I try to read some things and see what might be useful or fit in or be related and all that. There's another story appeared a couple, 3 days ago on, I think it's Yahoo, about the super secret Nazi weapons that would have won the war if they'd been properly deployed. And again, the coincidence with the gold train and the... Yep. I see conspiracy. I'm sorry. I see conspiracy.
Well, this is what I mean. Because we have been kind of distracted, because the narrative about World War II has been so heavily on the side of the Holocaust, which is as it should be. We should be reminded of it, I think, all the time. But what we have to do is look at the root causes of that and look at the people who escaped at the end of the war and the money and the gold that escaped at the end of the war to finance the Nazi resurgence, to finance a different kind of Nazi resurgence. The Nazis were a combination of hard science on the one hand, as we know from the V1s and the V2s and Wernher von Braun and Dornberger and the whole nine yards. We know they had science. And at the same time, they had pseudoscience, like the eugenics racial programs. Mm-hmm. And then they had the esoteric aspect, which was very strong. The swastika itself, you know, and all of the other weird stuff that went along with Himmler's Annenerbe and all this other stuff.
And
there was a mystical and a scientific blend that was taking place that we have to now really look at.
And an ancient, ancient history component.
Yeah.
See, that's the thing that really gets me, because, of course, I've been looking at really ancient civilizations with super incredible, fantastic weapons and technology and all that, and I've been looking to see where there were threads that the Nazis had picked up on to kind of back-engineer and to look back, way back, to what they felt they had a right to, because genetically they were part of that system. They felt they were related. They were intimately involved with, quote, the gods.
Yeah. And this is something that we're going to find throughout history. We have to, I think, stop thinking in terms of narrow categories. I mean, we have scientists thinking about science. We have religious leaders thinking about religion. We have mystics thinking about mysticism. We have divided up human experience into these little boxes, and they don't talk to each other. There's a deeper truth in our reality. There's something that's deeper that's going on, and the UFO phenomenon is one aspect of it. It's probably the most blatant one, because it's right there in front of you, and nobody can agree on what it is, because we don't have the tools. We have divided up our consciousness into too many moving parts. So we're not able to bring it all together. We have to be Renaissance men, essentially. You know, we have to bring it all together and look at reality a little differently to understand what the Nazis were doing.
Well, you and I met there in Amsterdam at that very interesting conference, the Secret Space Program conference. And there was another presenter who had the misfortune of following me, and I took too much time, and he's not like me ever since. His name is Richard Dolan, and he set up a remarkable line of historical inquiry. He talks about the breakaway civilization, that the Kammler group and those technologies and physics literally went underground at the end of the war and then emerged in whatever form an 800-pound gorilla wants to emerge, with technology that could take them freely off-planet or to the Antarctic and then off-planet. So we're really, from my perspective, the Fourth Reich is alive and well. It's just kind of invisible until you see these weird stories that someone is feeding us, I think, to get us to look deeper and to realize big picture what's going on all around us that we're oblivious to.
Right. And I think what I call the phenomenon, which is I use that term because it's broader and more encompassing than talking about UFOs specifically or the Nazi secret weapon specifically, but the phenomenon, which is part consciousness, part science, you know, part mysticism, you might say, part psychology, part biology, part all of that. I mean, there's tendrils that lead from it into all of these aspects. People who are bold enough, courageous enough to look at that directly without worrying about what their colleagues are going to say or they're going to lose tenure or whatever it happens to be, they look at this material straight on, they'll see what we are talking about right now. Between you and I, we are talking about this. We're talking about something which is deeper and which has a side effect in reality that's immeasurable. We are walking around like sleepwalkers, you know, concerning what's actually happening around us. We're kind of half asleep. We're not really seeing it because we're being massaged, essentially, by media.
Oh, the spin doctors are...
They're going nuts. And we're participating in the massage with, you know, with social media and everything else. We get distracted by all of this, and another day goes by, and another day goes by, you know, where we could have really looked at what is really going on and gotten a handle on it. And it is more than... It requires really a cultural education that we just don't do anymore. It requires, you know, a deeper understanding of the laws that are at work. And the laws of physics are not the only laws. There's other stuff happening, and consciousness is something that needs a more sophisticated approach. Otherwise, we're not going to understand what this phenomenon is, and the people who do are going to be that breakaway civilization that Dolan talks about.
So back to Poland and the gold train. Do you have any sourcing that actually has any facts about this, or it is all rumors?
Oh, there's no rumors. I mean, they knew the trains existed. They just didn't know where they were. They thought maybe one of them just went off the rails somewhere, literally or figuratively, and wound up in Eastern Europe somewhere. Well, Poland was Eastern Europe until recently. I mean, it was part of the Soviet satellite system. So they thought that, you know, that's it. We're never going to see that again. Well, now, with the fall of the Soviet Union, a lot of the treasure hunters have come out of the woodwork, and they're starting to look at all the old documents. This train did exist. We know the train existed.
So we have ID numbers and numbers of cars and inventory and the stuff that was supposed to be on it and all that?
We have rough ideas of what was on it. The Nazis at the end of the war were not keeping very good paperwork. So we know it was an armored train. Which means that it was designed to be, you know, to defend itself against strafing by aircraft and other stuff. So it was a treasure train of some kind if it was that heavily armored. And we know it was in Poland. What these guys are saying is that they've known for the last 15 years, generally speaking, where it was. They were just not able to get close enough to look until, you know, the political situation had, you know, calmed down. And now they're actually, you know, looking at it. They have eyewitness testimony from one elderly man who was alive at the time when the train disappeared, and they have diagrams.
How do you disappear a train?
Oh, yeah.
If you want to bury a train, imagine what that would take to bury a train.
Yeah.
What about hiding it in a tunnel, except the sealing off the tunnel? And
this is basically what happened. It's a tunnel underneath a mountain.
Okay.
And so they blocked up the tunnels. They covered it over like it didn't exist. And that's where
but
the train allegedly
is. But you've got tracks leading up to one side and away from the other side. That's kind of a giveaway that there used to be a tunnel here.
From what I understand, from what I've been told, all of that was torn up, taken away. People were scavenging metal at the end of the war. They were tearing stuff up wherever they could find it.
So it wasn't a deliberate campaign to hide it. It was just the scavengers just took the steel and the ties and the.
Oh yeah, they were part of the problem of disappearing this train.
Okay. So do you think it's just gold and artwork, or is it what I'm hoping, which is some really extraordinary research stuff?
I'm hoping so, too. I'm hoping it's not just – I mean, gold would be fine, but I'm hoping it's not just gold. I'm hoping it's other stuff, too. I'm hoping it's technical information. I'm hoping it's blueprints. I'm hoping it's parts of a secret weapon, maybe, something like that. You know, it's an armored train. Knowing the Nazis, you know, you could go either way. It was either a lot of gold – you know, Goering famously was trying to seize a lot of gold and artwork at the end of the war and get out of the reach of the Allies. Or I think more pragmatically, it might have been weaponry. We know the Nazis sent through by U-boat to Japan some documentation they had and some technical specs and some parts for an atomic weapon they were going to give to the Japanese because the Japanese were still fighting the Allies in the Pacific. So they thought, you know, let them have the atomic bomb, you know, and you know, we're not going to be able to do it. So we seized that U-boat on the way to Japan. So they were not the Japanese were not able to get it, but they were sending documentation, engineers, parts of, you know, half finished bomb material and everything else. They were close to an atomic bomb. And so whatever they had, they were shipping over to the Japanese. So they were getting stuff out of the country, out of the reach of the Allies.
Okay, so if we know generally that this train or a couple of these could exist in this region because of the documents, why is the Polish defense minister, I think his name is Tomasz Simoniak, why is he saying that it's hugely exaggerated to say the Polish military are looking for the gold train?
Well, yeah, of course he's going to say that. You know, there is so much actual evidence that this exists, and the two guys who found it are going through a lawyer, only asking for 10% of like a finder's fee. They're not trying to hoax anybody. I mean, they're not going to get paid
until they find the train.
Right.
But 10%. I mean, imagine if there's what? Let's just say 40 tons. Okay. At today's prices, 40 tons of gold, 10% of 40 tons is. They'll be set for life.
Absolutely.
So why is there such ambiguity? In other words, if they actually got ground penetrating radar, which of course implies some technical and financial support, why is it still so ambiguous?
It's a political hot potato right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Polish government doesn't want a whole bunch of treasure seekers there, so they're going to poo-poo this thing. They're going to try to take over this thing themselves, one way or the other. If they know what's on the train, there may be some issues there. There may be a reimbursement
situation. I was just thinking there must be a list of who they stole it from.
Yeah, they'll be able to identify it, which means that they won't be able to keep what's on the train, most likely. A lot of that's going to have to go back to its original owners. If it's artwork, they'll know the provenance. They'll be able to get it back to whoever, you know, originally had it. The gold, they may even be able to identify where the gold came from, depending upon what condition it's in the train. If it's in gold bars, bullion, gold, what they call biscuits, the small pieces of gold. So it's going to be an idea, you know.
With stamps and numbers and all that.
With stamps, numbers, yeah. If they're able to, the Polish government is probably thinking to themselves, there's no real margin in it for us to go to the effort of digging this train out. Plus, it's probably also mined. It's probably booby-trapped. You know, that's a very good possibility as well.
Well, if it wasn't buried, and, you know, the press over here doesn't kind of focus on Europe very much, so the stories have been kind of mangled, but if it wasn't buried, if it was sealed in a tunnel, it could be sitting there, mined to the wazoo, so that if anybody did break through, they'd make short order of them, and the gold will still be around.
Yeah, well, you know, the Polish defense minister you mentioned, you know, he was very clever in his use of language.
Yeah, he says hugely exaggerated.
said it was hugely exaggerated.
That not like, that it wasn't happening, yes.
It was a non-denial denial, it's which we know from Watergate. You know,
very Clinton-esque.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go.
There's another story here. Last week, an unexplained brush fire reportedly broke out close to the Gold Train site.
Yes, right.
Accident? Coincidence?
It could have been an accident. There's a lot of treasure hunters, you know, scrambling all over the area now, trying to see if they can have access to it. And it's possible that it was an accident, or it was set, as a warning. You know, it's Poland. We don't know what's going on there. We don't know what, you know, who's telling what to whom.
Mm-hmm.
But it's possible it was an accident. I leave that open.
We've got about a couple of minutes. This is going to be your, obviously not your last visit to the other side of midnight. So kind of leave us with where should we be looking in the next few months? What's going on that we should pay attention to that's not what it appears to be?
Wow. Well, keep an eye on the new Nazi news that's coming out, because there's going to be more of it in the next couple of months. You're going to hear more things that we were not really expecting. You're going to find out more. People will start talking about Nazi influence on terrorist organizations, for instance. You know, they're going to start talking about that a bit more openly, probably. They're going to be you're going to find more news coming out, probably, of a slightly paranormal nature. You know, things that are not going to make you go, you know, really, this is what they're trying to tell us. So I think there's going to be a bit more of that coming out. I'm not quite sure what, but there seems to be people are talking about, you know, maybe some kind of a disclosure of some kind, not a government disclosure, but some kind of some news that's going to be hitting. It's going to make us think even more about, space, the extraterrestrial hypothesis and all
now
of this.
I didn't lead you in this direction, but it's a great setup for you got to listen to us on Saturday morning. We're going to make a little news here because there's some astonishing images coming from NASA, from the Ceres mission and the New Horizons mission, and they're sending us a whole bunch of brand new high-res images of Pluto. And Peter, there's stuff on Pluto that's not geology.
Outstanding. Got to see it.
And there's our music. Well, thank you. My guest this morning, Peter Lavenda, I really want to thank you. You have opened a door that we're going to keep wide open and walk through many times. Until we meet again tomorrow morning on the other side of midnight, remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning.